Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to increase major planned and principal giving. QBAC acts as a force multiplier for fundraisers, enabling them to focus on what they do best, developing deep relationships with prospects and cultivating them into lifelong donors. QBAC automates the qualification process beyond simple scoring to ensure that your fundraisers have the best prospects. QBAC also uncovers actionable insights about current and future prospects to help fundraisers develop personalized cultivation strategies. Start closing bigger gifts in less time by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. Hi, Brian. I am delighted to have you on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. You and I have not seen, we had dinner with you and a friend in Indianapolis right before the pandemic, and we have not seen each other physically since then, and we haven't had much conversation. So I'm delighted to have you here on the podcast. You've had me on, you've given me the favor of having me on your podcast, and so I'm delighted to now be able to return the favor. Before we dive into our conversation, Brian, how about we just ask you to introduce yourself?
Well, hi, Jason. And I think you do me a favor because we get into these LinkedIn fights. You know, we've both got opinions about donor engagement. So it's refreshing to be on somebody else's podcast. Well, yeah. Hi, everybody. I'm Brian Gower. People refer to me at RNL often as the Giving Geek. It is my actual license plate. It says Giving Geek on it. I was a annual giving person and a planned giving major gift person. And then I came over to RNL about 8 years ago and became their chief fundraising researcher. I do a lot of our content, help build products, work with our great team. But I continue to be the giving geek, which is, I think, one of the things we're going to talk a little bit about today. But that's kind of what I do. I spend all day thinking and learning and running experiments and just figuring out how people respond to charitable requests. It's kind of what I do.
So, Brian, before we do that, you and I saw each other. I think it was we had dinner, mm-hmm. in, like I said a few minutes ago, in the – was that the fall? That was the fall of 2019, right?
That's right. Distillery 205 in the fabulous Fountain Square of Indianapolis. Right. Yeah.
Right. It was fantastic. It was probably the highlight of my – one of the highlights of my fall. I really enjoyed that. We were doing some – one of my colleagues and I were doing some other work in Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. So I was delighted that you and your colleague hosted me that evening. We had a good time. But I got to get a cat before we dive into our topic of discussion. I've got to get an update on what's going on with you and your firm through the, mm-hmm. in the midst of this pandemic, because you guys are right there in the midst of fundraising, just like the rest of us. And you've got to have, I'm very intrigued and very eager to hear sort of your read on what the last 18, 24 months has looked like since you and I last talked.
Well, nothing like having a couple thousand college student engagement ambassadors, sitting in front of phones and texting and video, and all of a sudden nobody can be in the same room together. So that's what happened. I mean, we continue to be one of the biggest engagement outreach companies in the world, particularly higher education, although there's other organizations in there as well, too. And we had launched a new platform, RNL Engage, where yes. the tagline, that the most read email that I sent out to the community last year was had the subject, "We retired Phone-a-thon." So it's my highest click rate. So we retired Phone-a-thon. And what we mean by that is, of course, we're obviously still calling. That continues to have great impact. But integrating in things like P2P texting, personalized video messaging, and then advanced analytics to drive the effort so that you're focusing on the right people, not annoying donors. I mean, we can get into that if you want. But we had launched that, and then all of a sudden, COVID hit. right? So this great transition we were making, getting rid of Phone-a-thon, moving to the engagement center, getting rid of the caller and moving to the student engagement ambassador, right? Change in terminology, yeah. Changes our thinking, all that yep. hit right at the time that then all of a sudden we couldn't have people in the basement of the student union at a major university. We had to figure out a new way to do it. So our team very quickly pivoted and created a PCI compliant remote engagement solution that continues to do all those things that I just mentioned. And that was transformative. During that period of time, two people used the RNL Scale Funder platform to set up student emergency funds, institutional emergency funds, supporting the vaccine effort. I mean, all the stuff that universities yeah. and organizations are so deeply involved in. I think there was a point where we had $9 million come through on our platform in like 10 days. So the donor wow. response during the pandemic, you know, seeing, you know, and we think about students, you know, they essentially got, you know, scared. Obviously, everyone was afraid they were going to get COVID. They got a pink slip because their student jobs on campus ended, or if they're working in a restaurant, we know how all that went. And they got an eviction notice at many institutions because they had to leave, right? The institutions couldn't house them anymore. So right. all of that changed. But what was really interesting to see is immediately advancement professionals were coming to us and saying, how do we continue engagement with donors? How do we continue to keep these students employed? Because we know that our donors like to hear from them. And so it's really an incredible time. I can share with you some examples of things that people did, but it was an acceleration of transformation to our company. We say engagement first, digital first now a lot at R&R, yeah. but we're continuing to see incredible value with those engagement ambassadors and increasingly volunteer ambassadors on the crowdfunding and giving day side. So that's kind of what's going on with R&R right now. A lot of integrated technology, a lot of partnerships, those sorts of things.
It occurs to me, Brian, that you might be one of the people out there in the fundraising space that might be. So one of the things I'm noticing in my client work is as I'm interacting with people in other parts of the marketplace, what the pandemic did in terms of their growth is it actually created a new customer. Have you guys at RNL identified sort of a new, maybe a new donor or a new donor pattern? I wonder if it kind of occurs to me that perhaps there was something you just said a few minutes ago that occurred to me that perhaps you guys picked up on a new donor. Did that in any way happen for you guys?
Yeah. So
did
yeah,
you I pick think, up on that.
Yeah, I think there's going to continue to be people who buy into the branding and the mission of a quote annual fund or annual giving, right?
Yeah.
But there are also going to be many people who sometimes along with that, but sometimes totally separate from that, embrace the idea of giving through an institution, not just to an institution. And I'll unpack that yeah. a little bit. So when we see Dolly sure. Parton come forward with $1 million to support vaccine effort, right? She's giving through the university she gave that to support that effort, right? We saw many, many campaigns, particularly in our important national discussion about diversity, inclusion, and justice, where institutions have been doing work in those areas for decades. Now they throw up a crowdfunding campaign and all of a sudden donors are saying, yeah, I want to give to that effort. Many of those people who are the people who were not responding to the general annual fund effort before, some can do both, right? But there does seem to be this group of donors. And I don't, I used to say things like, well, this is how your millennials are going to give. I don't think it's a generation anymore. I think there's a cause-oriented, impact-oriented, giving through as well as to oriented donor that's out there. And yeah. some of this new technology and just the fact that like COVID caused us to all just drop our attitudes and like be real, man. It's like nothing like waking up every day and like wondering if you're going to survive. I mean, and yeah. we can joke about it a little bit now because we have vaccines. But I mean, this continues yeah. to be an incredibly scary global issue, right?
Definitely.
But it's interesting because higher education institutions and social service agencies were absolutely part of getting us to where we are now. We got work to do, but getting us to where we are now. And they are also the incubators of the vaccines and the technologies that made this even possible. And I think donors saw that, you know? So we just saw incredible things. So one university, you know, it's like, oh my God, this is hitting. We can't like just go out with a solicitation tomorrow on like March 20th. You know, we can't right. do that. So then we got to get a little space, you know? So as they're putting up emergency funds, the institution says, hey, we got doctors who understand what coronaviruses are. Sent out a text and said, you want to come to a Zoom where the doctor just talks to us about what this is?
Yeah.
It was like thousands of people. And the institution got like 850 address and information updates as a result of that. So on face value, it's like, well, that's not a solicitation. Well, that's a non-solicitation communication. Actually, you know what? That updated contact information just a few weeks later drove that institution to some incredible success on solicitations. You know, nothing like having 850, 1,000 better, newer, you know, more accurate addresses to drive your giving day that maybe you had to delay or retool, right? And so I think the industry, like our advancement professional colleagues, are waking up to the idea that it's not just about asking, man. Our alumni are more than walking ATMs, and this is about a lifetime relationship. And when challenging times happen, you know, we got to work together, you know? So it's a lot of inspiring things over the last 18 months.
So one of the things I think the pandemic, one of the things I'm consistently hearing and I'm writing about is I've read some papers about what is called perceived proximity. And this is research that's out, that's been out there for quite some time. And this is all as it relates to platforms like the one that you and I are on now that have been in place for two decades, you know, since the dawn of the internet. A lot of these platforms have been there. And that only in the midst of the pandemic did we actually see the value and experience what extraordinary efficiency can be created, but at the same time, what these academics are calling perceived proximity. And what they're also saying that I think sort of translates into a lot of these questions of remote workforces and are our fundraisers working from home and et cetera, is that if you're really good at this, you can actually be better at creating what is human proximity in the sense that we can create meaningful engagement. You and I can be interacting just like we are right now without having to be in the same physical space, because we as human beings are learning how to adapt to the tools that are between us. You and I right now are having a conversation that's really no different, enjoying ourselves no differently than we did at that bar that evening in Indianapolis.
Well, the drinks were better.
Drinks were better, but we could buy our own drinks. It actually would be cheaper, right? I could bring my own. And if I'm embarrassed, if I want to buy a cheaper bourbon and I don't want to unimpress my friends, but the thing is, I mean, it's the fascinating thing. I guess the question I'm asking is did from a, you know, in a positive sense, and what folks like you all are sort of advocating for is, did the pandemic sort of prove that we can actually do high touch, very meaningful engagement with our donors, and we don't have to hop on airplanes to do it, and we don't necessarily have to host, you know, cheap chicken galas necessarily either? We just have to learn how to do what you and I are doing right here.
Yeah, well, you've heard this from me before. I'm whatever on the cheap chicken gala. I've been to dozens of them. I recognize that there's some value there. If you're going to do a cheap chicken gala, fine, go ahead, set it up, get the food and everything. Bring in your arts community, have your students perform, have a student compelling student speaker. You know, stop with these flat, you know, let's just glad hand the 25-year donor galas. Let's actually get into what's happening at the university. Have a professor get up there, get edgy with it. You've heard that from before. But to answer your question, the pandemic did change things. I talked with one university. I was talking to their chief advancement officer, and I said, you know, how's this going with your leadership and your gift team? And he said, you know, Brian, my president gets up now and is on Zoom with three donors before he even starts his first meeting. And I like, you know, that was a full day for a traveling president fundraiser before. I think the other thing too is when we talk about removing barriers, what we forget, and I think we'll get into this when we talk a little about the donation equation, is that making this easy and facilitating is a key part of what we do. So I know how major gift conversations go. Maybe I've met that individual and we know that there's interest. Maybe I get with the partner or spouse. Ultimately, on a very big gift, the children can be involved. Other people can be involved. Certainly a financial planner could be involved. Increasingly, donor advised funds, other things are involved. Well, what we just described there is like eight plane trips. What if instead it's one or two plane trips? And then as we're closing, and when I say closing, what I mean is making everybody feel comfortable with the investment. Maybe it's a group Zoom meeting where the financial advisor is on there as well too. That is an advancement officer's dream. And what I'm hearing from people is that particularly as we get into the final stages of those conversations, so it may be an impact at the start stage. Hey, are we aligned? Is this worth us meeting in person, if we can do that safely. But even later in the conversation, when you have to bring in different parties and groups together, it could be absolutely incredible. So I think it's a game changer. I do think that advancement continues to be 7 to 10 years behind on technology. We've talked about this before. And and what the pandemic did was, you know, gift officers woke up and their world changed. And so people had to adapt. I know it was difficult for people, particularly, you know, you're having a major gift conversation and many people had to, you know, be educators to their kids and deal with the dog barking and the Amazon package coming and all that stuff. Right. But, we're at the end of the day, we're just real people. We're all experiencing the same reality of having to do this. I think if people can lean into what they liked about the change and continue some of these shifts, it's good. What I'm really worried about is people reverting back to business as usual, because business as usual was often a really crappy donor experience.
Well, yes, I totally agree. But I think part of what the temptation is going to be is, and you know where I'm going with this, I think part of where the temptation is going to be is to utilize the tools that we've now learned how to use and try to go like hyper efficient on it and stick with the quantitative metrics and not understand. I like what Peter Thiel talks about how having competitive technologies versus complementary technologies. Mm-hmm. And I think like what we're doing here, complementary technologies are technologies that enhance what only humans can do. And so can we benefit from, or what I sometimes call back-end efficiency, rather than trying to front-load efficiency into our processes, can we recognize that, like I was talking to a gift officer here recently, not in higher education necessarily, but I was talking to her and she's like, you know, I got 500, 600 names in my portfolio. Well, at the end of the day, that's not really necessarily having these exaggerated sort of portfolios of donors isn't necessarily where the efficiency needs to come from. It needs to come from the fact that I don't have to get on those 8 airplanes all the time, right?
Yeah, I don't need a stock pond of 500 fish to go fishing.
Right.
Right. A nice place to sit with my friends. And you know, I'm gonna get to know the fish, so to speak. Like fundraising is not about efficiency. Right. Philanthropy is not about efficiency. And our alumni, as I said, our alumni are not walking ATMs and our gift officers are not gift vending machines. Right.
Right.
So I understand that, and I would tell that person with 500 or 600 people in their portfolio, well, let's call that a group we're looking at. Let's look into the engagement data of those individuals, what they're doing, and let's find the 50 to 75 that you should focus on right now. That's where I think by the way, and people have heard me say this before, when you do that, it's a better donor experience, because the things that you'll do in the 500 to 600 group to try to go after them in a depersonalized way is probably just going to annoy them. And there's probably a charity closer to them that's doing it better. I don't actually think a lot of times people choose between charitable organizations. I think people who can make these transformational gifts probably could support just about any group they want to. But you are going to lose attention span if you're doing it in a depersonalized way. So there's using technology to listen, I think, is a key component of this. I'm not opposed to somebody having 500 to 600 people in a hunt group, but the amount of people that a gift officer can focus on is one. Now, maybe you do one 3 times in a day. But we can all pretty much focus on one relationship at a time.
We had a guy at the Naval Academy on here, I don't know, 6 months ago. Maybe it hadn't even been that long, back in March or April. He was talking about how he engaged with half as many donors, raised almost the same amount of money that he would have in the previous year. But the people he talked to actually wanted to talk to him. And it was that last comment, the idea that in the midst of the pandemic, if you're talking to half as many people, like the 75 people you just referenced, think about how many more development officers we could keep in there. It becomes a solution to the turnover problem that we're constantly whining about. If we can put half as many donors in front of them, raise the same amount of money, let them sit in their bedrooms like I am and do their work and raise the same amount of money, but actually let them talk to people who want to be talked to. I mean, that's the design and sort of the creation of these jobs that I think if we could, and that's why I'm interested in having this conversation about your equation, because I think the more science that we can align with qualitative mm-hmm. with qualitative understandings of human beings, you know, rather than quantitative human, which is, I just think that we're going to be all the better. So, Brian, I asked, you were at the Giving
Institute.
Tell me where you were. Yeah. You were at the Giving Institute.
Yes, 55 companies. We get together kind of as a consortium, and we talk about how we can do better things for our client partners. We talk to researchers about donor behavior. We had great people from Giving Tuesday, Do Good Institute, just an awesome Giving Institute. Shout out to my pals there. It was great. But they offered us the opportunity to present a 7-minute lightning session. And I shared something that I had shared in previous presentations called the donation equation.
I decided to pick on that a little bit. And I'm a little skeptical of metrics and things of that sort. And you agreed to come on here and sort of unravel that thing. So
I'll give it to you in just a couple minutes. All right. So I was a gift officer. I had been in annual giving. I was a gift officer, and I'm going to go move over to this company. I said, okay, well, now I got to figure out, surely someone has created the grand equation of donor response. Surely there's an answer to these questions. There's been research that I imagine you're probably already chuckling inside, because we know that there's not, but we'll get into that in a second. So what I did is I made a fake email address, and I signed up for every company's distribution list all the major companies that we all know. At the same time, I was also enrolled in a PhD program. So I was regularly looking at academic research as well, too. I just went with this fake email address after everything. At the height, I got 412 emails a day. That email, by the way, is gone. But what I did is I started to take all this research, the product pitches, the products themselves, stats that were quoted to me, and say, can I create buckets for these? Because it's impossible for any advancement professional to try to figure out behavioral psychology, behavioral economics, sociology, marketing research, all that stuff. It's impossible to keep track of all that, but could I create some buckets? And the buckets started to build. And I said, well, I'm going to a case conference and I'm going to start presenting on this stuff. And the buckets changed, but it ended up being 6 things that seemed to be validated by research experience. Obviously, I'm doing my podcast at the same time and talking to experts about this stuff. 6 things, and I'll give them to you. So the first 2 are baseline. Number 1 is philanthropy. So just the basic ability, history, education about giving. We know that philanthropy is a learned behavior. So what are people's previous experience with giving, right? Is that even part of their psychology? So that's the give. Then there's the get component, which I called gratitude. I originally called it stewardship, and a great case member corrected me and said, stewardship's what we do. Gratitude is what donors feel. So this is the get component. So philanthropy plus gratitude, what do you get? Tax benefits, tchotchkes, warm glow feeling, invoking Andy, right? So what is the give and the get? So that's the first 2. Those are the baselines. And then those are amplified by 3 accelerants: connection, story, and urgency. Connection is your connection to the cause, connection to the asker, connection to peers who may be soliciting you or may be present in the materials or volunteers. Story is, what is your personal narrative of giving? What is the story of impact that the organization has? So we hear about storytelling. So story is a component. And then urgency, which is the answer to the question, why give now? That's answered in higher education often by giving days, crowdfunding campaigns, lots of ways that we manufacture urgency or amplify urgency. Gift matches, gift matching campaigns that have a deadline are a classic example of urgency. So philanthropy plus gratitude times connection, story, and urgency, some combination of those 3, all of it divided by the final variable, which is barriers or friction. So how we make it harder to give. Crappy giving pages are an example of making it harder to give. Not having clear instructions about security transfers on your website to make it easy for people to give. That's an example. Maybe requiring donors to meet with you in person rather than getting on Zoom. Right. Rather than asking, what would you like to do? Right. So that's an example of friction. So philanthropy plus gratitude, the baseline, amplified by connection, story, and urgency. All of it divided by barriers. And there's a lot in there, but what it's worked well when I've talked with people and use it in my consulting work and at conferences to say, you can pick one. So I'll give you an example, classic pick one, connection. Anytime we change the person who signs the letter, we see a different and often larger group of people respond. So if your letter, your fundraising letter, is always coming from the VP for advancement, sorry to break it to you, not everyone cares about the title VP for advancement. When you switch when you switch the signer of that letter to a student or a faculty member or a fellow donor, even if you change almost nothing in the content, just the stuff that's necessary to make the voice work correctly, you will often see a very different group of people respond. I remember when I was on my first volunteer board at the American Red Cross in Knox County, Illinois, former state senator took over as the executive director. He took the letters home, and we printed them in black and he signed them in blue. We had like four times the response rate on that direct piece. It was like, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. So Carl, shout out to Carl on that. So that's an example of a thing that you can pick and change up. What I've mentioned a lot of times in the presentation is if you just have to pick one thing, work on that barriers component. Because
go high level with me for a minute before we, because I want to let you unravel this some more, but so one of the things that I'm consistently doing here on the podcast, I'm sort of picking on the sort of what I consider to sort of be the 20th century definition of a fundraising expert versus the 21st century definition of an expert. And I think it's going to be an evolution, Brian, of moving from best practices that are sort of assumed to be sort of universally accepted to more of a more appreciation of sort of a localized and sort of contextual appreciation. And I think what it's going to do is it's going to put a pressure on this is sort of what I'm because what I just heard you describe that I didn't sort of see when you were discussing this on social media is I'm seeing the experts, the people who are sort of privileged to stand in front of audiences like you and I and to get on here and have these conversations and stuff, who perhaps are quote unquote experts by some definition, we're going to be the creators of tools rather than best practices. Does that make sense? So tools being things like what you just described, which I'm far more accepting now that I've actually had a conversation with you about it. And we put it in the hands of the local user, which is the development officer, the advancement director, the person creating the web page, whatever, da, 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 da. And then the expertise actually emerges from the use of the tool that we created, handed it to them. It's used in their local context. And it becomes an emergent sort of form of expertise that actually is really almost better articulated sort of later down the road. Like it may not be necessarily you and I that get to stand in front of the room so long, so much forever, because it's actually got to be, you know, Sally or John who used your tool and actually can actually articulate what sort of expertise emerged from it. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. We did a student philanthropy conference before the pandemic. And what I did is that we actually went through the equation and then we had a worksheet and everybody went down in their program and they picked a couple things. And just to see what people did at when they had a framework. So the framework is just, I could come up with 25 different variables. Right? Yes. It's just a way for us to pick specific areas that we can focus on. And part of it is you got to be really careful. I'll give you one story. We're a major research university and I'm sitting in front of them presenting to their entire advancement division. And we do the Q&A afterwards. And they said, well, we're having some trouble with acquisition. And I said, well, describe to me your donor acquisition kind of package. And one of the things that was in there was a 5-page letter from the president of the university. And as you know, I just immediately said, well, you're nuts. Like, there's no way for a brand new donor that a 5-page letter, like all the classic fundraising wisdom would be, you got to get it to one page. You know, like maybe you would do more for the consistent, loyal, recurring, whatever donors. But a 5-page letter to a brand new donor, I don't know. But then they stopped me for a second. And what we all realized was that the president of that university is the former governor of that state, who was elected two times, because of term limits, by extraordinary margins, very well known, right? So in fact, in that instance, yes, correct fundraising instinct is you want to do a shorter letter for brand new donors and capture their attention. But in this case, there is a much greater willingness for the population to view that and accept that because they know this guy, so to speak. Yeah. So what I said to them is the key shift that you got to make is you probably need a slightly shorter version or somewhat shorter version for the new donors, and then get those new donors the opportunity to go then maybe watch a video from the president, because what we want to do is we want to see them take their first action. Okay, because that is getting to the story version. All behavioral change, all learning is incremental. We assume as fundraisers that we will create the coolest appeal and everybody will just respond. Every adoption of a cause, every investment, every philanthropic act is actually incremental, including when I give at a checkout, right? And it's incremental mm-hmm. because this is how my mother taught me to act, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a long incremental thing there, but I pretty much always give, with the tack on gifts at a checkout, right? But all that is incremental. And so you have to provide people an incremental path. What we do too often is just give them the big thing we want them to do and see what percentage of them do that. We're leaving out a tremendous opportunity for engagement, for people to create their own personal story, right? And this holds up in research. When we look at what Russell James has done, connecting planned giving donors to fMRI and actually finding that the areas of the brain that activate when people contemplate these types of philanthropic investments are actually the same areas that activate when they contemplate their own mortality. So not just at the, hey, leave a legacy level, the language we always use in fundraising, but biologically, the same parts of the brains that he called symbolic immortality interact. So it becomes very much a first person transition. I don't know. I'm just nerding out here trying to give you some idea of what it is, but I think you're absolutely right. There is no fundraising expert that has, quote, the answer. There are people that I'd go to. I go to Erica Wasdorf on recurring giving. Right. Absolutely. Okay. Right? You know, so, I go Dan Allenby. I go to him all the time on annual giving stuff. Right. I mean, there's people like that. But I think also there has to be a willingness to say, well, how's it specific to our program? What else can I bring in here? Most importantly, what are we hearing from donors? Are we surveying our donors?
I want to give you credit where credit is due. I think you've created a tool that when you like the story you just told. I think you've created a tool that when we put it in the hand, so who, if it was a tool and it's the right tool for the right development officer who's using it in the right place, who is that person? Tell me who that person is. Because what I initially heard you describe and what I think you almost, what I think we're talking about in some ways, the online giving sort of transaction, the page. But what I also heard in between the lines of, I think what you described is not a whole lot different than a tool that could be used by a major gifts officer as he or she is planning out essentially a relationship building process and a solicitation process. Am I right?
Yeah. So we could break it down for a major gift officer. The philanthropy component, you're probably going to focus on people that you know have some wealth or have a history of giving, right? There could be exceptions to that, right? On the gratitude component, of course, if that person is given annually or been part of your organization, you hope your stewardship team has thanked them. On the gratitude side, we all can be advocates for philanthropic inclusion in political policy as well, too, right? So those are going to be there. On connection, story, and urgency, there's some interesting ways you can mix it up. A major gift officer, I had so much success getting, and I was a fundraiser in Hollywood and New York City, mainly Broadway. These people are very busy. They got a lot of people looking for their time and attention. They got a lot of people looking to take advantage of their fame and fortune, so to speak. On the connection side, I had 100% yes, I'll take a meeting rate when I brought their directing or acting professor with me to Hollywood or New York. And I sat with, we won't get into names, but I sat with people who I regularly see on television right now and had incredible experiences with them talking about how their lives were changed at 19, 20 years old by this directing, acting professor. And of course, the gifts flowed from there. Right. One of the biggest gifts that I received was an actor who just loved piano. So it's actually not the theater professor. He wanted his piano professor. Right. And it was absolutely incredible. So we play with that connection side. On the urgency side, what we're starting to hear is that in some cases where a major gift isn't right for right now or there's some stall in the process, asking that major donor to be a matching gift donor on the giving day. Say it's a $5,000, a $10,000. You may be working with that person on $1 million commitment. But in the interim, asking them to be one of the ambassadors that stands up a match for an hour's worth of giving on your giving day, those conversations are going super well. Because the major gift owners are like, oh, that's an opportunity for me to help, right? And they get into it more. And now all of a sudden what we find is that bigger gift conversation is accelerated because they're more comfortable. Right. And so we can play with any one of these variables or whatever variables. Yeah. You don't have to use my equation. You can use whatever you want. But I think always be thinking. And people have heard me right before. I believe that moves management is a mirage. I'm not saying that you shouldn't use the system, but it is a fundraiser facing system. We should be focused much more on the donor experience and some of these key things like what's the narrative here for the donor? What is the connection to who we're bringing to the table? Why give now? Why give now? Like you could do it anytime. You could do it. Why are we seeing people signing the giving pledge and giving during their lifetimes? Right.
Yeah.
And the answer to that is because they want to be involved. Right. So those are some of the things So that's a gift officer side of it. That's a gift officer side. You would do it differently for a campaign. You would do it differently for annual giving appeal. You can apply it on a micro or macro level.
Yes. Right. I totally see that. But I want you to stay with the. Somebody asked me, I don't know, 6 months ago, 9 months ago, in some sort of a, I think we were in a Zoom workshop or something, and they asked me what I thought the skills that were going to be necessary for 21st century fundraising were going to be, given some of the evolution of what was happening at the time. And I said two things, and I sort of surprised myself. You sort of shoot from the hip with some of these questions sometimes. I said discernment and audacity. And I wonder if the discernment that I was basically referring to is I've also been studying up on this notion of what are simple rules or heuristics, these things that basically you structure simple rules or basically equations that if I can sort of and we do this in my seminars, too. We basically have these simple rules, these structures mm-hmm. that if you can sort of discern these various different sort of qualitative and sometimes quantitative indicators, you can sort of predict where these relationships are going to go. And that's what I sort of hear in what you're basically have created in this particular tool. Does that make sense? Could be onto something about creating that more discerning donor so that rather than maybe relying on a bunch of I'm very opposed to some of this predictive stuff. And so rather than being predictive, can some of the prediction happen by combining a tool like yours and a fundraiser who has more discernment in their head and they've sort of been engaged with this donor and they can use that data, that information, that level of engagement that they formed to then be able to predict it at a more human level rather than a machine level. Does that make sense?
Yes. And what I always say about predictive analytics is that they're going to get you to the right forest, but they may not even help you get the right trees. And so predictive analytics.
Right, exactly. I'm seeing your tool as we're stuck in a really big damn forest and I don't know who the hell to talk to. But if I've got this tool in my hand and I'm engaging with if I'm sufficiently engaging with a large number of these trees, and then I use a tool like what Brian's given me, I can better discern who to talk to and invest more time in.
Yeah, I think there's probably three levels. One is to say segmentation. So we just know, for example, that people who have given before are more likely to make a major gift. That doesn't mean you won't ignore the people who just give for the first time. And that does happen. But that's segmentation. Then predictive analytics to say who is showing the highest level of engagement right now. So that gets you to a tighter group. But that's, again, only going to get you to the trees. You're not going to be able to prune a bonsai tree with predictive analytics. That's when your fundraiser skills... That's when your listening skills, that's when I think donor surveys, we've had incredible success with those. Seeing institutions double their young alumni giving through targeted outreach and literally serving the donors about what they thought. And some of the surveys for these institutions were hard to read. There was feedback given there. There were some tense moments as people started to read that feedback, but the institutions then were able to adapt, change that, and saw huge increases. I think finally, fundraisers don't work alone. Volunteer ambassadors, what we call natural partners who work with us within our organizations, other donors are absolutely key. I can't imagine going in for $1 million ask without some natural partners or volunteers helping me out. I can't imagine doing it. I don't presume to think that I am charismatic enough to make that happen.
Yeah.
Right? So why not work with our friends? And we saw this, for example, in giving days. It was initially with fundraisers like, oh my God, here's another thing that, you know, the professor's like, oh, another thing you want us to do. We got classes to teach. Will you leave us alone? And the deans were like, okay, whatever. This is the next gimmick. A couple of years into it, now they're like, oh my God, the dean in the other college is, you know, raising all this money. I want to get into this. Right.
Yeah.
And so what we find is when we engage natural partners in fundraising and philanthropy, it becomes addictive and they get into it more.
Yeah.
So,
Is enough of your inputs focused on the subsequent behavior after the initial gift to sort of, if you recall in my first book, I made this distinction between the initial and the subsequent gifts. And I basically made the argument that far too much of our industry is focused on initial gifts, generating all these sort of what I call trivial gifts that are relatively shallow relationships and aren't necessarily going anywhere. Is enough of your equation oriented towards, or is it completely oriented towards the subsequent gift sort of behavior?
So I think you can apply it across the board. One of the things that people have heard from me before is I talk about four types of donor behavior. So the first is transactional, which you just talked about. And what people, you and I have talked about this before.
Yeah.
What people forget is that when people make that first gift, they may not even know what they're giving for.
Yeah, exactly.
They did it because somebody bought them. They did, you know, right? And so then we have to really get into relationship-based giving. And that's when I think you subsequently help people understand what they gave to, educate them about the organization, really focus on mission. The third level is what we call lifestyle giving. And this is those of us who have donors who like call at the end of the year. You're like, oh, wait, did I get my gift in? I didn't forget. Like, they're so worried that they would miss. When you start to see that behavior, when the, you know, I will always be one of your donors and I hope I never miss. And now I'm at events and now I'm inviting other people. That's lifestyle giving. Most often you see those three types of giving before you see the final giving, which is transformational giving.
Yeah.
Again, there can be people who do that transformational gift right off. But even when we look at some of the mega philanthropy, great people like Mackenzie Scott who made these gifts, there's actually a process to that. And you talk to the institutions that received those gifts, there was a process that went through. And so a lot of that comes out of behavioral economics. When we see that people really kind of habituate and adopt a cause, recommend the Y-axis, John List and Yuri Nisi, W-H-Y-axis, Derek Feldman's great work on cause adoption. You know, we really start to see people go through a psychological, to some degree, I mean, not in the religion sense, but spiritual transformation.
Yes,
right?
Yes, very much so.
Mm-hmm. By the time they go from transaction to relationship to lifestyle to transformation, there really is, it's an aha, it's a spiritual transformation in many ways. So that's a key thing. What the donation equation does is says, what are the things that you can change, that you can shift? What variables can you use? Classic example, send out the letter, maybe from the institution, but then follow up with three emails with videos from a student, a faculty member, and a fellow donor. Because we know on a connection level that there are going to be people who are more moved by a different voice. I'm always amazed that institutions will set out like a direct mail piece and go, well, this is our response rate. Well, like, what was the campaign that surrounded that and created a narrative and a story and allowed people opportunities to connect? We think that we know that we can make the pitch on how people connect. Donors decide where they're going to connect. So provide a menu, a robust menu of opportunities to connect for them. Don't just hang it on one appeal. You do that, you're going to lose a lot of money. You're going to waste your resources and you're going to annoy donors.
Okay. So you mentioned Mackenzie Scott and you think about, so let's relate for a minute. Let's spend the last 10, 15 minutes relating your giving equation to the what we might call sort of marginalized or overlooked higher education institutions that she's giving to, for example, who perhaps have not had the infrastructure, the infrastructure or expertise historically to raise gifts from, say, that upper echelon of society that she's now giving to, for example. We're talking about, like, in many cases, a lot of HBCUs are getting a lot of gifts from her, for example. If they can actually take a tool like yours and begin to develop sort of some of this discernment that I'm referring to that a lot of fundraisers need to have, are we in some ways, when we, I think in a lot of ways for years, we've been talking a lot of people have been talking about the democratization of fundraising and of philanthropy and so forth. But I think in a lot of ways, it comes from some of this discernment that the fundraiser has to be able to have. And a lot of that has been exclusively in the hands of these institutions that can pay for, you know, super talented, super experienced sort of individuals. But now you might be the local HBCU, for example. It's got a 2-year major gifts officer, relatively inexperienced, an annual fund director, maybe an advancement shop that has no more than 4 or 5 people in it. And I've been on some of these college campuses like this. But if they can actually start to understand fundraising like you're describing, they can perform better than, in some cases, the big, huge mega institution down the street. Do you follow my thinking there?
Yeah, I mean, what I would add to
actually enables, the tool actually begins to train them up to behave at the level of performance that the shop down the street has sort of been enlightened with for perhaps decades, if not centuries.
What I would say is there's plenty of fundraisers at HBCUs that know a lot more about fundraising than I do. HBCUs accomplish incredible things with very limited resources. In my opinion, their lack of resources is criminal. I will literally use the word criminal. HBCUs produce for their students and their communities success, academic success, degree and attainment at essentially double the rate that we would predict those same students to get in another environment. HBCUs are an absolute treasure of the American public, and they do so much with limited resources because of structural issues that we've been talking about in an intense national discussion. It's a real thing. What I love about what Mackenzie Scott did, and she outlined this in the post that she wrote, seeding to seed. So seeding, C-E-D-I-N-G to seed. So she actually giving the money with no restrictions. And so is a type of philanthropist that says, this is the change I want to make in the world. We have looked at what these organizations are doing, and we trust you. We see what you're doing is great. And so we're going to really make the contribution and let you go for it. That is, I think, a new form of giving. Even just a few years ago, I remember, we got to make sure our gift agreements have four pages because, you know, the legal side and then down the road 15 years and then the kids and then we might lose the gift and, you know, all these things. It's like there are a lot of philanthropists that are just very comfortable with your organization. And when you ask them, where do you want to make a difference? Even a very broad category are going to be very comfortable doing that. I think this is a new wave of philanthropy. I think what Mackenzie Scott and her team has done is incredible. I've talked with people who are recipients of the gift and the process that they went through. It, very, very quick, very speedy, and confidentiality and things like that. But the way they did it is just absolutely incredible.
Okay, but do you, in between the lines of what you're saying is, and what I'm trying, again, I'm trying to sort of lend credit to your tool here. If the HBCU is inclined to think on the receiving end of the way that Mackenzie's giving, and they use a tool that embeds sort of simple rules into their thinking rather than gift, like for example, gift agreements, which these large institutions like writing up ridiculous contracts with their donors as if they're, you know, it's obnoxious in my opinion. And that could be a competitive advantage that you give to a lot of these institutions that haven't historically looked at fundraising. They've been, what I'm getting at is they've been looking at fundraising through the wrong lens because the only fundraising they see is fundraising from that big institution down the street.
Right. And I think part of it is to really get to what are you giving your gift officers in terms of tools and support? So the average organization that say has five gift officers could probably the next time one of the positions becomes open. And from the data, what we see is you're probably, if you have five people, you're going to have a position open every 6 months forever.
Yes. Right.
That's just the way it's going to be. So the next time you have an open position, use the money that you would have used for that interim period. It's probably going to take you a while to hire somebody and put tools in place to support your other gift officers. Where we've seen people do that, they've had extraordinary success. We assume that we just take charismatic people, give them big old lists of hundreds of people and send them at them and to go get the money. And like, that's like it. That's like insanity. Like no sales organization would even consider doing that. They have multiple levels of sales support. They have technology in place. And so the issue with the structural issues in the haves and the have-nots in higher education, which unfortunately have often fallen on race lines, they certainly fall on class lines, they certainly fall on location, rural, urban lines, right? It's created a situation where people really can't move forward. So I think last case report, the top 12 institutions raised 21% of the funds. So like less than 1% raised a fifth of the funds. You know, and so I think donors are looking at that and saying, well, if you already have this massive endowment war chest, there's a classic article called The Dark Side of Endowment Accumulation. You can read about that. You know, we got to go in some different directions here. Number one, tools. I think number two is saying that giving through as well as giving to, right? Because where can you have an impact? You know, maybe the answer, if you have a $3 billion endowment to the giving side is, can you help us with this new initiative? Can you help us with this associated organization, right? Can we take our mission to the K-12 schools and provide support in that area? And there's been some great gifts that have helped that as well too.
So would you concur on the, and I have not said this on the podcast, and I would give you all the credit in the world for sort of putting this idea in my head. there are far more McKinsey Scotts in our current databases than we give ourselves credit for sort of having. I think there's a lot of people out there who want to give. They don't have anywhere near the capability that McKinsey has, but they want to give in what is a much more less strings attached sort of way. And we just have to know, getting back to the notion of engage, getting back to a lot of the places where we started this conversation, get on a platform like this, have meaningful conversations, kind of like what we talk about in gift economies rather than commodity sort of economies. I think people just want to engage with their recipients in meaningful ways where the relationship is at the center of these things. And if our experts were sort of pushing tools out there that enabled fundraisers to sort of discern that way, they'd find a hell of a lot more McKinsey Scotts in their existing database. Am I right?
Yeah, I think giving is always a leap of faith, right? So you're not getting...
Exactly. It's a leap of... Gee whiz, you got me riled up. A leap of faith is just another word for risk. And risk is an inherent part of what a gift economy is. And I just don't think that we know how to operate in that paradigm.
No, and what we've been doing, and again, I'm like the least religious person in the world, but I'll use a religious metaphor, is what we've been doing for decades is writing sermons. So we think that we can stand in front of a room of people or in front of a person and make a pitch. And what you find is, when you look particularly at religious giving, that's not how it happens. It's also attending the church dinner. It's the connections you have with peers. It's the history with your family, right? And so for us to, as fundraisers, to think that we can make a pitch and get somebody to give, that's going to work for a very limited set of donors. What we should be doing instead is, number one, finding the right people based on engagement data. I'm still going to make a pitch for that. And number two, doing a lot more listening. The organizations, and I'm an advancement resources grad, the training that teaches you how to listen better is just way better. Now, just want to keep in mind that when we say listening, some of that can be digital. I continue to be amazed why people don't survey their donors, do quick forms. I just did a conference recently, donor engagement forum, where we just asked everybody, what do you want to most hear about at the forum? And we tailored the content based on the hundreds of responses that we got. And it was way better event. And it cost us nothing to just add that field. 70% of the people filled it out. They wrote cool stuff, right? So we got to do a better job with that listening.
I think I'm going to start picking on, I haven't started this, but I think I'm going to start picking on gift agreements. Going back to your pitch analogy, I really appreciate that because I think you're exactly right. I totally concur with that. Are all these highly sophisticated sort of contracts that we do a result of that pitch approach?
Well, they're results of litigation, fear of internal conflict, the nuts
shallow and bolts relationships.
I think that there are issues. I mean, I think that we have endowments that exist at universities for things that no longer can be supported. They don't even exist as majors anymore. Down to some of endowments agreements we're finding that probably should have never been created in terms of our feelings about justice, inclusion, and diversity. So we're working through those things. So I think there is an interest in making sure that we get the documentation right. But what I'm worried about is documentation first fundraising. It needs to be engagement first fundraising. There will be a point where you work with people, maybe even a financial advisor or a lawyer connected to that family, where you're going to do a formal agreement, and it very well may be 4 to 8 to 80 pages, right? But to present a donor early in the process with a proposal that's larger than one page, I wouldn't do it. So I think if you can't depict it in one page, because they're going to share it with their kids, they're going to share it with their financial advisor, which is an individual that has limited time. It has to be. Yeah. For a donor advised fund, if they're going to direct a gift from a donor advised fund, it needs to be like one freaking sentence, man. For those of us who have gotten these calls from donor advised funds where they ask you the questions, you got to answer those questions. They only have time for like one question. And the question was always, can I ask you, is Mr. Lewis involved in the selection of the person who receives the scholarship? And I'd say, no. Thank you. The funds will be on the way. Click. You know, and as an early career, professional that's making that just call to make sure that it's legal and stuff like, you got to be able to have those quick answers right away. There will be a time where your endowment, and maybe even say to a donor, hey, we're going to do this brief gift agreement now. We'll handle the legal components of it later. But are we all on the same page? Again, incremental. Stop jumping to the big aha. All behavioral change, all cause adoption, all giving decisions are incremental. Stick with that. Yeah. You're going to have a lot more success.
Yeah. And kudos to you for creating a tool that perhaps I'm a little more convinced of, because if you can utilize tools, if we create better tools for people to use in that incremental process, they won't be so inclined to jump to these overly complex things that oftentimes interfere and make the relationship a whole lot harder for both sides of the charitable exchange. I think that's part of what is sort of emerging from a lot of this tension, is that in the fundraising space, is that we have not designed fundraising to create meaningful experiences for those on both sides of the charitable gift. And so when you put these, when you put the right tools in the right incremental sort of place in the process, it makes for a much more meaningful work and a much more meaningful experience for the donor.
We've created a lot of fundraising tools to sell CRMs and to make fundraisers feel better. It's time to create tools that allow us to connect better with donors, listen better, and create a relationship that, again, is about incremental adoption. And I think that's the direction we're seeing the industry go right now. And the companies, the fundraisers that are leaning into that are doing a lot better.
Brian, you do call yourself a fundraising geek, and I like to pick on geeks because so I'm the guy who picks on you, and you're the guy who proudly says I'm a fundraising geek. I love it. Every time we get together in person and on the podcast or your podcast, I enjoy the conversation. You're obviously well-read, and I respect that a great deal. I think you're onto something. If people are interested in learning about the donation equation, they want to reach out to you, how would you suggest that they do that?
Then you just head over to ruffalonl.com. You can find me there on the website. You can also read our blog and check out Fundraising Voices. That's where we talk about this stuff. This has been an experiment over the last few years. I'm happy to come to your organization and present the equation and ask you questions about how you think you could use some of these things. It's about creativity. It's about challenging the norm in the way that we do donor engagement. And so that's why I created it. So happy to do that for anybody who reaches out to me.
And is there something I can put in the show notes, something that people can very quickly download, or a link or something? Can we do that as well?
Well, actually, just go with my email and I'll send them the worksheets and all the stuff like that. So brian.gower@ruffalonl.com, and we'll get you all the materials.
Okay. So everybody look in the show notes. There is an email to Brian. You can reach out to him. And Brian, it has certainly been a pleasure. You're always welcome back.
Okay. I'll pick a fight with you on LinkedIn next, and then we'll record another episode.
Okay. Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.